So the first thing that would be helpful for me to get from you would be for you to say your first name, last name, and sort of position or how you would like to be known on the episode.
Oh, that's a good question. you can call me Joe Morgan, math teacher. I mean, I'm kind of not officially a math teacher, but that's what I like people to call me.
Okay, and then if you could say your first name, then spell it, last name, then spell it.
Joe, so that's JO, and then Morgan, MORGAN.
The first sort of official question of the interview is how long have you been teaching now?
Oh, I've been teaching about 10 years now, and I wasn't always a teacher. I used to work in banking. So after university, I became an analyst in a number of investment banks. And then in my late 20s, I became a teacher. So that was now 10 years ago. So apparently, if you've been teaching 10 years, then you are no longer a novice, you become an expert. So hopefully, I'm just sort of bordering on becoming an expert teacher at this point.
So what pushed you to make that jump? That's a rather a distinct employment pivot.
Yeah, and I wonder, I often wonder if it was the right thing to do because obviously this is a considerably more challenging career I'm in now, and a less lucrative career because, things were easy back then. In my 20s, I earned more money, I had an easier job, I had shorter hours. But I think, well, there was a kind of a turning point. There was a specific incident that gave me the idea, and it was when I worked for Macquarie, which was an Australian investment bank. And they were very keen to do things with the local community. And they sent an email around to all the bankers asking if we would like to go and do a presentation in a local school about careers in banking, which was just part of this school's kind of careers program. And I volunteered really for the sake of my CV. I wanted to sort of have little things like that that I could use at job interviews and that would give me extra skills. I knew I needed to improve my presentation skills. So I went along from totally selfish point of view. I wasn't thinking at all, oh, I could help these students or anything like that. And I went and did this presentation in a really tough kind of, it was a in a London school. The kids scared me a bit. I had never worked with teenagers before, really felt out of my comfort zone. And I did a presentation on careers in banking. Wasn't sure if it was going well, wasn't really getting much reaction. And then at the end, they all put up their hands and asked the most wonderful questions. It was just such an amazing moment. It was like a turning point in my life because they all put up their hands and asked me questions that made me realize that teenagers ask really good questions and teenagers are a nice group of people to spend time with because they said things that surprised me and that excited me and that made me realize they were really smart and had all this potential. And I literally went back to work and sat down at my desk and thought, wow, that was a really interesting day. I feel different to how I usually feel. I had this little buzz, I felt this kind of job satisfaction I'd not felt before. And that was it. And then off I went and found out how to become a teacher.
So from that point when you became a teacher around 10 years ago, how were you sort of getting the ideas of how to make your lessons, what you were going to be using in those lessons?
Oh, now I did my first training placement was in a grammar school. And so I guess I got a lot of my initial ideas. Now, a grammar school being a selective school, so students have to pass an entrance test to get in, so quite different to other schools in this country. And I got all my ideas, I guess, from the mentor I had there and the other teachers there. And they had a very different style of teaching to other schools because they were teaching a very different type of student. So we were very textbook driven, and we could pretty much just sort of explain something for 5 minutes and then give the students a textbook and they'd work for a good 40 minutes, absolutely fine, sort of independently. And it was it. And then later on, when I moved schools, I realized that that kind of teaching just wasn't effective elsewhere. And that's when I kind of, it was around that time that I joined Twitter and started going online and finding out this whole other world of maths education. So I guess the first sort of 5 years of my career everything was kind of a bit unexciting and a bit lacking inspiration. And then suddenly things changed for me. And I discovered that there's all these wonderful ideas and different ways of doing things. And that really came from joining Twitter for me.
So, I mean, in reading other interviews you've done, in listening to your appearances on other shows, I have noticed that this sort of moment of joining Twitter really sort of was this massive pivot point, this time of change for you. And so I was wondering if you could go a little bit deeper in explaining sort of how Twitter sort of changed the way that you approach teaching.
I think part of it is just the community on Twitter. So there's huge amounts of maths teachers who, like me, will just kind of in an evening or a weekend just go on there to chat to other maths teachers. And I think the thing that really struck me was just this huge level of enthusiasm and excitement about sort of teaching topics that can sort of sound really unexciting to teach. So, you know, if you go on there and say, anyone got ideas for teaching, I don't know, box plots or something that sounds really dull, then you get all these, you know, loads of replies, people who say, oh, I did it like this, it worked well, you know, I tried this thing, didn't work well, oh, here's a great resource. And I think it's just this, I found that it's the enthusiasm and the willingness to share ideas is really quite inspiring. But also, you know, the fact that you can go on there and say, oh, has anyone got an activity for this topic? And you kind of get inundated with replies and people sending you links, which is just so much nicer than kind of Googling it. You know, you to get those kind of personal recommendations and you find all these hidden gems all the time is really lovely. It's such a good place. And alongside that, you know, there's some difficult things. You know, there's people who argue and disagree about the best ways to teach, and sometimes it gets heated. But if you sort of, you know, step away from kind of some of the negatives and just sort of see this wonderful sharing community, it can totally transform the way someone teaches, you know, if they kind of embrace it. And some people will join and it won't really be for them. But, you know, someone like me who's really just really got stuck into the conversations and the sharing. And if I did something in a lesson, then I would look forward to going home and talking about it on Twitter if something went particularly well. You know, that kind of thing, just it turned out that it was a place that I sort of fitted in well, and I really sort of thrived on being able to talk about my lessons.
So before you were on Twitter, did you feel that being a math teacher made you part of a community, or did you not really feel that community point until later?
No, and I think that was possibly to do with the school I was in, where we were very inward facing and we didn't do anything with other schools. So in the first 5 years of my career, I didn't speak to a maths teacher from another school at any point, and it didn't seem like there were any opportunities or any desire for anyone to do that. And then the other thing that came along with Twitter is that as soon as I joined it, I started going to events, because you sort of join Twitter and you see these conferences and all these things advertised, and they're often at the weekends. And as soon as I started going to those, then I felt like I was part of a community of actual people and not just people online. And, you know, that just adds to this wonderful feeling of a kind of cross-country collaboration, you know, sort of math teachers all in it together. And I think, yeah, before there may have been things like that happening before, but I feel like in the last sort of 5 years since social media has really been a thing, I feel like there's tons of stuff happening that math teachers can physically go to at the weekends, and I don't think that stuff used to exist. And I think it exists now because social media has been a way of communicating those events.
So your blog is titled Resourceaholic. In order to talk about that, could you explain what you mean by resource?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I kind of wish it wasn't the title of my blog, although, you know, it's because I used to be, when I say resource, I kind of mean tasks or activities or worksheets or ideas that you can use in the lesson. So for example, if I was talking about resources for teaching solving equations, then there would be a whole load of stuff that comes under that category. And I'm thinking of paper-based resources or things that you can put up on your screen. So sometimes it's just a set of questions, or sometimes it's, you know, a kind of code-breaking type activity and that sort of thing. And I think the problem is I used to teach just from the textbook, and then I had a moment where I had a trainee teacher in my school, and I saw her at the photocopier, and she was photocopying a really lovely activity for trigonometry, and it's called trig pile up, and it's a really popular activity, so lots of people would have heard of that. And it's basically it's a worksheet, but it's got a load of triangles piled on top of each other, and you have to use just right angle trigonometry to work out the length of the hypotenuse at the top or something, but you have to start from the bottom and work your way up, and everything links really nicely. And it's a really lovely, colourful resource, and it's really engaging because it's kind of like a puzzle, but you're just practicing. And that was the moment where I realized there's this whole world of lovely resources out there, but teachers don't know where to find them, or teachers spend ages looking for them. So the idea behind one of the ideas behind my blog is that I just give teachers quick, easy access to what I think are the sort of nicest resources available for their teaching.
So when you're doing these, you're both sort of making some that your own versus curating other ones that you have found through various means. And so could you talk a little bit about sort of that dichotomy, the ones that you are actually putting together versus the ones that you're sort of aggregating?
You see, I don't really see myself as an expert resource maker. I make a few things myself, but really I'm sharing lots of other things. So, you know, occasionally, to give an example, which is very much a UK or even a British example, was every summer our students do exams, and they do GCSE exams, which they're assessed on at age 16, and they come in the morning of the exam, and quite often schools have sessions where they see their students immediately before their exam, and they kind of want to give them a warm up of some kind, to just, you know, do a little bit of maths before your exam to kind of get your brain going. So last summer I produced a whole set of those that were really popular, and they were just, this is a nice, easy to print set of questions for your students to use just before they go into the exam when they come in the morning, just to sort of warm up their brains and remind them of a few key things. And that's so I'm making things that I would say are not sort of particularly mathematical. So I'm making things that are helpful for teachers in their sort of day job, but aren't sort of very deep in terms of the thinking involved or the maths involved. And I kind of don't claim to be making anything that's clever mathematically. Whereas there are some resource providers like Don Stewart and MathsPad and these other sort of wonderful websites, and Malcolm Swan, who made all these amazing resources, which you can find in places like the Standards Unit and Maths Assessment Project, and they are really clever resources. So I share those, and I'm very excited when I find a new one of those, or if I use one of those, and I talk about how it went. And that's what I do a lot more than making my own resources.
So I'm guessing I might be able to figure out the answer to this on my own, but I'd like to make sure. Where are you finding all of these resources? Is it just from Twitter, or have you built sort of a wider net at this point?
I think no. Some of them are, yeah, someone will share something on Twitter, and I think that's great, and I'll add that to my resource library, so I'll blog about it. But no, I mean, I plan my own lessons, and the thing is, because I'm an actual teacher, and I'm still planning lessons, that means that when I'm planning my lessons, if I can't find something great for a particular topic, then I will go and look for it online. And I suppose I'm pretty good at finding these resources because I kind of know where to go. We have a website in this country, TES, the TES, which is where teachers go and upload things they've made for their classroom. And I'm actually a reviewer on TES, so a sort of voluntary work that I do, where every few months I do 40 resource reviews. And that's quite a nice way of me seeing things that teachers have made. And the idea is that if you imagine a teacher who's not been teaching too long, and they've made something for their own class that they really like, and it went really well, And then they think, oh, it might be nice if other teachers use this. And what they'll do is they'll go and load it onto TES. And then if it weren't for our team of reviewers, then it might be that no one ever sees that, because there are, you know, tens of thousands of resources on TES, hundreds of thousands of resources. So that might get lost. But the idea is that our little team of reviewers, we go on and we look at all these new resources that have been added, and we find these little gems. And it's just really nice for those new teachers who have never added something before to kind of get some feedback and get a sort of nice review saying this was a really helpful thing to share. So I guess, you know, part of, you know, I find resources in lots of ways, but, you know, I'm involved in all sorts of things where we're trying to encourage new teachers to share things, or teachers, experienced teachers who've just never shared things before. Because the interesting thing about sharing certainly in this country is that in a way we're all in competition with each other as maths teachers, because the grades that they award in this country at age 16 and grade and at age 18, the sort of the qualifications that they award are pretty much done on a normal curve. So, you know, if the whole country gets better at teaching maths, then it doesn't mean that our students will get better grades, because basically the curve just moves up. So, you know, they'll always give the top 3% of the country the top grade. And if we all share our resources and all the schools around us get better, then it means that our own students don't have an advantage. So you could argue that we're all in competition with each other, which means we shouldn't collaborate. But that's sort of a really sort of unpleasant way to think about it. You know, a collaboration makes us a sort of happier community, and it gives us this sort of lovely job satisfaction and this feeling of belonging. So we have to sort of put to one side the fact that we're essentially competing with each other, and we have to sort of just ignore that and see the advantages of sort of being in it together.
I mean, that's a great way to think about that. I never fully understood the idea of grading on a curve. I always sort of felt like if you meet this level, you should get the grade.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's a horrible situation here, because if you at age 16, if you are deemed to have failed your GCSE, which means you don't achieve a grade 4, the scale goes from 1 at the bottom end up to 9. So if you don't achieve a grade 4, you're made to resit. And that means that when you're 16 years old and you might have moved to a different college, then you have to do your maths GCSE again. But the problem is that, yeah, that boundary moves every year. There isn't a sort of set number of things you have to know or set, you know, it moves every year because it depends on how the rest of the country does. And I think it doesn't sit well. It doesn't feel right. And you're right. It should be that if you know certain things, then you pass and end of story. But it's a bit of an unsatisfactory feeling the way the assessment system works.
Now, I haven't been as in touch with the UK math education world as I used to be back when I used to do maths with Peter. But I know in this country we have been going through a bunch of curricular changes, and I think that at least in the last decade or so the UK has too. So what sort of effect has that had on sort of the resource creating and the math education world?
The curriculum changes we've been through in this country have really been sort of small tweaks to the age at which people see things. So it's not quite as profound as what's been happening in the States. And I think that from my understanding, I think that there's been some quite I know that sort of there's some quite controversial things happening in the States in terms of approaches to teaching and ways of explaining things. Whereas I don't think in this country there's been anything nothing's going on that's quite such a big deal. We've had some changes to qualifications where, for example, at A level, which is what you study at age 16 to 18, is now assessed in a linear way, which means that they do all the exams at the end of the two-year course, whereas they used to do them in modules. They used to do them as they went through. There's been some increase in difficulty level of the exams they take at age 16. So that's added quite a lot of pressure, and that's across the board. That's in every subject. So students are particularly stressed about things that, for example, have happened in English, where they now have to learn lots of quotes and they can't take the text into the exam with them that they used to, and things like that. And then there's been a few shifts at primary school as well. So for younger children, there's some slight changes in the sort of content, where it's been some stuff has been moved out of the primary curriculum and into secondary and vice versa. So there's been a few changes, but nothing huge. It's just been a move around of topics. But I think something that's sort of changed, some other things that have changed, sort of not to do with curriculum, but to do with pedagogy, is there's been a bit of a move towards really looking at the latest research and sort of evidence-based practice. There's been things in this country kind of go in cycles. Mark McCall, who knows a lot about the history of maths education, will talk about the kind of 30-year cycle where everything shifts in terms of the way we teach. And there's certainly been some changes in the last few years. There's lots of new ideas of how to deliver things in the classroom, and that has needed new resources. Quite simple example there would be that when we sent teachers over to Shanghai, so the government decided that we should, as a country, go and learn from the teaching in Shanghai, and we sent some teachers over there, and they came back with lots of ideas, particularly for primary school. And there's some of the ideas, and these are not necessarily ideas from Shanghai. These are ideas that have been around a long time. But there was this thing about when introducing a concept to show examples of that concept and non-examples. So say, for example, I want to explain what a square is, then I could show pictures of squares in various orientations, and I could show pictures of things that are not squares. Now, this is nothing new, and this has been around forever, but it's not something that I've really ever seen teachers do in their classrooms very much. But that's something that's now become a really big thing. And so as a result of that, increasingly, when I look at resources for delivering teaching, there are examples and non-examples. So it's something that just in the last sort of 6 months, we're starting to see more and more of in the resources that teachers are using. So, you know, that's just stuff that kind of evolves over time. And I think a lot of the ideas we're using at the moment aren't necessarily new, but they are things that are kind of back in trend, or sort of fashionable things in teaching. So, yeah, so I have seen changes in resources because of the latest trends.
Now, I've over the last couple of years actually started limiting my social media use. Do you ever worry a little bit about how much time and effort you have to put into sort of maintaining this community and the connections that you have to it, and making sure that you're seeing all of these resources online versus, you know, spending time on other personal development?
Absolutely. It's overwhelming, and I kind of it does make me feel, I don't know, it makes me anxious at times. I feel like I need to be on Twitter all the time, because I feel like I'm a part of that community where I contribute a lot, and I see that as an important thing. Perhaps it's a feeling of self-importance there, which is perhaps unwarranted, but I feel like I need to be there sharing things and keeping everyone kind of feeling motivated and inspired. Whereas actually, you know, in reality, I could stop doing that and it would really not make a huge amount of difference. You know, it becomes something where it feels like such an important part of my life. Whereas if I actually step back, it's like, well, you know, I could give that up and everything would be okay. So yeah, I do struggle with it because I have two young children. The thing is that being on Twitter has given me lots of career opportunities. So it's something that the job I'm currently doing has certainly been a result of all the sort of stuff I've done in the maths community. And so when I kind of say to my kids, oh, I'm going off to a conference at the weekend, or oh, I need to write this blog post, I hope that what I'm doing with them is I'm showing them that I can be their mum, and I can have a a career that's important to me and that I'm passionate about. And I hope I'm kind of being a kind of inspirational career woman to them. And that's kind of something that I think about a lot. But yeah, you're right. At the same time, it does become quite all consuming. And I certainly, I would say that Twitter and maths education is my main hobby in life, if not my only hobby. But, you know, I guess it's temporary. It is the hobby of my 30s, and, you know, things will change. So, you know, I think that it's okay.
Well, for people like us who live on the internet, like we get to be a part of these communities, but we're a minority still to this day. Yeah. We are definitely a minority. So what about say the math teachers who are not living on the internet? What sort of things might they be missing, or do you think that they're not missing much?
It's interesting, because you're right. It is a tiny proportion of math teachers that are actually on Twitter or using my blog. I, at the moment, my job is, I have an unusual job for a math teacher. Just for this year, I have a role where I go into schools and support teachers. So I have sort of two or three schools that I visit regularly, and I go and observe teachers and I help them out. And it's really very apparent from the first day I started doing this that none of them are aware of my blog and don't use it to find resources, that many of them will kind of discover something. So they'll say to me, oh, I'm using a resource from Pixie Maths or MathSpot. Now, these are really, in my mind, very well-known resources in this country. And these teachers are saying, oh, I found this website. And I think, how can they have just found it? I've known about it for 5 years. I've used it all the time. And it does make you realize that, yeah, that there's a huge amount of maths teachers in this country who through not reading blogs or going on Twitter or not kind of just knowing people that can tell them about these things, just don't know about these things that can really save them time. I do think they're at a bit of a disadvantage. And the disadvantage might not be it might not be that they're a bad teacher. They might be the most amazing teacher, but I do think there is a time-saving element where, you know, the sort of stuff we're all sharing online, is there's some really great quality stuff there, and it's the sort of thing where if a teacher doesn't know about it, then I do think they're missing out, and I do think that they might be spending lots of time making similar stuff themselves when they could just use something that's already been made. I don't really know how to fix the problem, though. I don't think there's any way that we can necessarily reach every maths teacher in the country with this stuff. And, you know, that there'll be people that haven't been on a training course in the last 10 years and haven't been to a conference and haven't done anything other than use a textbook and deliver lessons that they've been delivering for a long time. And I don't really know how to reach them.
Well, if someone, now this is a long shot, if someone for some odd reason listens to this show and isn't involved in an internet mathematics community, which, as I said, is a long shot, what sort of advice would you have for a mathematics teacher who is just starting to think about using this trove of internet resources?
So I would suggest to first of all not be put off by any kind of negativity. So it used to be, before people were on Twitter, in this country people were on TES, which is the website I mentioned where people share resources. And TES had communities like message boards that used to be the way people would communicate online. And they became quite, at times, quite unpleasant places where people were very critical of each other. People would ask for advice and be kind of patronized, or, you know, sort of, they could be quite unpleasant. And I think if you sort of joined a community and you see that kind of thing, then straight away you think, well, that's not nice. I'm going to stay away. So I would start by just saying, you know, there's enough great stuff happening on places like Twitter that you can kind of, you know, I mute a lot of the stuff that I don't think is helpful. And so I just sort of follow and engage with people that are really positively sharing stuff. And I think for someone who decides Twitter is the place, you know, the thing is, if you join Twitter and you just follow a couple of maths teachers, then Twitter will start suggesting other maths teachers to follow. And you could then you very quickly have a whole load of maths teachers you can follow. And then, you know, if you if you start replying to their stuff, or if you make something yourself and you tweet one of these people and say, hey, I made this thing, have a look at it, then suddenly it won't be long before you find you're really immersed in this community. So I think it's, I found when I joined, I was surprised how easy it was to really straight away just sort of find my place there. You know, I signed up to Twitter. I followed a couple of people that I knew were maths teachers who kind of blogged at the time. And then very quickly, you know, they were my friends sort of within a few months, just because I was sharing with them and I was commenting on the stuff they'd shared, saying how it worked well with my students. So, you know, it's sort of quite easy to get going, even for someone who's kind of quite shy in social situations. You know, online social situations are way easier. And so it's quite a, you know, it's something that's easier than it sounds.
I assume another place people might want to start is your blog. So I was wondering if you could give a bit of an elevator pitch for your blog, what it is and how people could use it.
Okay, so I'd say there's sort of three parts to it. The part which is the...
Sorry to interrupt there. Could you start just by, you know, saying the name of it before going into the whole thing? Thank you.
So it's resourceaholic.com, and it's aimed at secondary teachers in the UK. So that would be secondary teachers who are teaching age 11 to 18. But, you know, I do have visitors from all over the world. And I think there's plenty on it for teachers from other countries, because it is essentially, you know, just maths. The blog part of it is where about once a week or a bit less these days, because I have a million things to do. But I try to write a post fairly often, which will either be about something I've tried in my classroom or something I've seen in a classroom, like an idea, a way of doing things, or it will be about something a bit more mathematical, like different ways to teach, different ways to do certain things. So, for example, different ways to factorize a quadratic or factor a trinomial, or different ways to find a... highest common factor, or different ways to simplify something. So I have I write about mathematical methods as well as ways to teach things. And then sometimes I write about things like, you know, I love old textbooks, and I write about things that I've found in there. So that's kind of the blog part of it. Separate to that, I've got resource libraries. So there's, like, for example, there's a page on algebra. And if you go to the algebra resource library, which are in tabs across the top, so they're very easy to find, then I've listed for every topic all my favorite kind of worksheets and activities. So people use that every day to find things for their lessons. And then the other side, there's one more part of the website, which is that I have listings. So, for example, I list events that people can go to, or I list trips they might want to take their students on. And I sort of have it's kind of like the information part of my blog, where there's no other place in this country where you can find a list of say, for example, good ideas for trips for students in maths. And there was such a lack of that when I joined the profession. I couldn't believe it. There was no central place for all that stuff to be kept. So I do that. So I'm kind of like a central information place for maths teachers, where they can find, you know, lists of stuff that is interesting to them. So there's a lot going on there.
And one type of posting that you put up, I believe, is become pretty well known. Could you tell me a little bit about the Maths Gem postings?
Yeah, so that was when I joined Twitter in 2014. I was overwhelmed by the ideas, and I couldn't figure out a way that I could remember them and I could keep track of them. And also, I thought, you know, I really want to share Twitter stuff more widely with people who aren't on Twitter. So I started writing these posts, and at first I wrote them once a week, and now I write one or two a month. And that's basically, it's five, I call them five gems, and it's five things I've seen on Twitter that I think other maths teachers will like to see. So it might be a puzzle, it might be an activity, it might be just a cool little maths thing that I think teachers don't know about. So I really enjoy writing those posts because I get to do a whole variety of stuff in there, and it's just a quick kind of, here are five things you might not have seen. And they are my most popular posts, and you know, maths teachers really appreciate kind of having that summary. It means if they're not on Twitter, or if they've been off Twitter for a few weeks, they feel like they're not missing out on kind of the big stuff that's been shared And it means that people get to see things that are kind of fun or a bit unusual. So yeah, they're kind of my big deal posts, I guess, are my gems posts, where I'm sharing 5 ideas from other people. And then I do a quick update on other things that has been going on with me. So I sort of talk, if I've done a presentation at a conference, then I'll share it there and stuff like that.
So this is going to be incredibly self-serving. You ever feature any podcast episodes in those gems?
No, but of course I'll be featuring this one. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, podcasting has become a really big thing. You know, Craig Barton's podcast in this country, which is where he interviews people about how to teach maths. That's been really interesting, because people who kind of don't have time to read blog posts or read his book, and people who are kind of feel like time is an issue, are really getting a lot out of his podcast, because they're listening to them on their way to work, or they listen to them when they go out on a run, and it's kind of CPD. So they're learning about maths teaching on the move, and it's actually become quite a big thing. So yeah, I think podcasts are clearly something that's increasingly a good way of communicating with teachers or with anyone. So yeah, that's quite an exciting sort of development in CPD, I think.
Yeah, I've always hoped, and I know that in a couple of cases it's happened, just not as often as I had hoped, that some of the episodes I've done, which are, you know, features, you know, stories like the story of Chinook, the AI that defeated checkers, have been used in lessons themselves as sort of a way to like help introduce students to sort of the larger world of mathematics.
Yeah, that's fine. I listened to, you know, you did one and it was a year in review, and you did, was it 1811 or something?
That was a re-air of something Peter and I did in like 2011, I think.
Yeah, and you know what? It was so interesting. It was really, really enjoyable, because you were talking about, you know, the sort of mathematicians of the day, and you were setting the scene for the day, and it was... You know, I've increasingly got an interest in the history of math education and of mathematics in general. So I've really enjoyed that. I thought that was really good.
I'm glad you did. I wish I could take any credit. That was entirely Peter's idea back in the math maths day. But it was so much. Those were a lot of fun to do. I was hoping to do a new one for like 1819 or 1719, but I just could not find enough stuff that related to 18, I guess, because it would have been for last December. One thing that you've mentioned a few times is how sort of being part of this internet math community has opened up a lot of like opportunities, conferences, and things like that. Could you tell like one or two of your like favorite experiences or like coolest things that you've been able to do because you've been a part of this community?
Okay, so one thing last year, and you know, I know that you were involved in this, the big internet math off, I think that's what it was called.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, now that's to me, so because I see myself as a teacher, and I struggle to see myself as a mathematician, because I did a statistics degree and then I worked in banking, and I never, you know, I was very much doing a statistical analysis in that time, and so I find, you know, I struggle to call myself a mathematician, even though I spend my days doing maths, but it's very much school level maths. So for me to be invited to take part in that was really, really nice for me, because it made me sort of feel like, you know, I'm a part of the maths teacher community, but to sort of be kind of joining a kind of mathematician community, which I see as sort of joined but slightly separate, that was really exciting. So that was a real privilege to be involved, and I enjoyed that so much. And then I think kind of off the back of that, that gave me a bit more confidence, so that when I went to the Maths Jam conference this year, and it was the Maths Jam gathering, the big annual Maths Jam gathering, and that was my second time going to the Maths Jam gathering, I presented this year, and you know, I don't think I would have done that before, but I think because I sort of see that very much as mathematician territory, and I feel a little bit kind of out of my depth there, but I presented this year, and I really enjoyed doing that, and I think that's to me, that's something that's really kind of made me feel a lot more confident and like I, you know, I am part of this mathematician community as much as I'm part of the education community. So yeah, presenting at Maths Jam was quite a big deal to me. I was really pleased that I did that.
Hey, is there anything around these topics that you think that I probably should have asked about, but I've just sort of let slip?
No, I don't think so. No.
Okay. No, I mean, it's I haven't been involved in education in quite a long time. Well, that's not entirely true. I'm now a librarian, but...
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, I'm the new, as of 2 weeks ago, I started as the mathematics and statistics librarian at the University of Michigan.
Oh, how wonderful. That's such a nice job.
Yeah,
wow.
I'm very excited. And so I'm going to be able to keep expanding on the work that I presented at the gathering about this year.
Yeah, how fantastic. Yeah, because, you know, I mean, the thing I do with the old math textbooks, and I've got about 50 at home now, ranging from kind of 1800s up to 1950s. You know, I have that has been the most interesting thing I've done in the last year is start to collect those and kind of spend my time finding out how maths used to be taught. And it's just been so interesting to this change in the language over time and the change in the teaching style and the change in the sorts types of questions and the difficulty level. Yeah, it's been really interesting. So, I think your sort of work as a librarian, you know, it will have lots of parts to it, I'm sure. But I think anything looking at historical stuff is just fascinating.
Speaking of looking at historical stuff, have you... Could you tell me a little bit about how the difficulty has changed from those historic problems to now?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because the way that maths, if you look at old maths textbooks from even just sort of 70 years ago, if you look at kind of the 1950s, they seem quite heavy. The exercises are long. But the explanations are kind of very wordy, and it sort of seems like, oh, you know, this must have been a pain to learn from. But actually, there's a lot that we can gain from looking at those exercises in terms of how to set challenges for our students. So, for example, if you just look at an activity on factorizing or factoring, as you say in the States, we have this. Say you have an activity on factorizing that says, factorize, where possible, the following expressions. And then it has a whole mix of expressions that go up to a really, really challenging level that we're just not seeing now. You know, we teach factorizing, but we don't give questions that are as hard as they did then. And there's no reason that we shouldn't. And also that even the factorize where possible thing, I mean, that's lovely. We would give our students now an exercise of expressions that can be factorized, and then we'd ask them to factorize them. But even just adding the words where possible, where students have to think, actually, this one, maybe it can't be factorized. You know, that just adds an extra sort of level of challenge to an activity. And it's such, you know, it's just little things where, you know, you look in a textbook now and there might be 8 questions to factorize a linear expression, and they will be a bit kind of similar, and there's nothing particularly challenging compared to 50 questions in an old textbook, which has some really, really great questions in that would be really lovely to give students, not necessarily to try on their own at first, but, you know, for class discussion, let's have a look at this really tough one. And you know, I think that I struggle to sometimes think of a really good challenge for a topic, but all I have to do is look in an old textbook and I know I'll find, you know, a question that will really make everyone have a good think. So yeah, they're full of ideas, and it's delightful to see what they used to do, but I don't know at which point everything became easier, and I don't know why everything kind of got dumbed down a bit. But, you know, having something happened at some point, and over time things have just kind of, I think, changed. We have a wider breadth of topics we teach now, and we just teach them in far less depth, which means that we have lost some of those really lovely questions.
That's what I was wondering if was the issue, because I know that we are definitely teaching more mathematics now. Like we're asking students to go a lot further in like pre-university than we used to ask.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like the actual depth is less.
Well, certainly, I mean, if you look at A-level, which is the, you know, it's students who choose to study maths at A-level, which they do between the age of 16 and 18, the A-level we teach them, we have very limited time. It's very, very rushed. And we teach a large number of topics, including some mechanics and some statistics. And then it's mostly pure maths, but there's a bit of statistics and mechanics in there as well. But it's a very, very light touch on those things. But what happens is that because it's such a rush to teach all these things in the very short time slot before their final exams, that nothing is taught in any great depth. And that means there's not a good level of understanding. And it means that our students will get to university without the sort of real strong understanding of calculus that the university requires. And our argument is, well, we just didn't have the time to do it in the way we'd want to because there's too much in there. And if they stripped out some of the topics that aren't 100% necessary, then that would give us more time to do it properly. And the same applies here in younger year groups. You know, it just feels like we're trying to pack too many things in and it doesn't all need to be there. And we could teach better if we had more time on fewer topics.
I know I've heard similar things from teachers here, especially now that more and more students are trying to, you know, get through the equivalent of like Calc 2 with the advanced placement test so that when they get to university, they can skip past both Calc 1 and Calc 2. And it's gotten kind of insane.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, I want to thank you so much for giving me your time today and talking to me about mathematics education, a topic I spend way too little time thinking about.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. And I always enjoy talking about math education. So anytime.